Become the CEO of your life. The Tea Talk with Oliver Herrmann and Kai Schrader.
Our guest today holds a degree in economics from Singapore Management University and has undergone training in disruptive strategy from Harvard Business School. As a management consultant, for some time also with McKinsey, he advised leading financial institutions and the government of Singapore on industry transformations. He blends his consulting work with extensive experience in coaching and more than 10 years of mindfulness practice, which integrates contemplative training from various wisdom traditions, including his time spent as an ordained Zen monk. Currently, he serves as the partner and global head of leadership solutions at Potential Project, where he blends neuroscience, mindfulness, and contemplative practices to help businesses adapt to the ever-changing and fast-paced digital world. His mission is to unleash human potential for leaders, teams, and organizations. He is also the co-author of the book Compassionate Leadership: How to Do Hard Things in a Human Way. Welcome to this Tea Talk, Moses Mohan. We are so glad to have you with us today.
Very happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me to be on this talk.
Hi, Moses, and warm welcome also from my side. It sounds like such an impressive journey. And we would be interested, like, how did you evolve throughout this time from being a management consultant to living as a monk and now like being a partner at Potential Projects?
Okay, thank you for the question. It's a big question. I'll try to give you a sense of my origins and what has brought me to where I am today. I grew up in Singapore in a family business that was very, very successful in the 80s. Back then, it was the economic boom in Asia, and both my parents ran a very successful shipping business. We employed most of my uncles, my aunties. So I had a front row seat of what I would call economic, financial, and even entrepreneurial success at that time. But at some point, it all came crashing down. My parents had the best of intentions. They were doing their best, but the Asian financial crisis hit. And due to some other challenges as well, basically the business crashed. And not only the business crashed, but also their marriage actually fell apart as well. So I was the eldest child, and I had the front row seat of how not to run a business in times of crisis, and also how not to actually run your relationship, especially if your business partners. So for me, that was, I think, a very, very formative experience, because it gave me insight into the world of business from a very young age. And something that really sort of sat with me, now that I sort of look back, is it really possible to be successful in the world of business and be genuinely happy and content in your private life as well? And this is something my parents, again, once again, they tried their best. They had their challenges. But growing up as a young boy, I felt that somehow the equation was missing. So I think that's something very important that I should mention up front. Fast forward, I was graduating with my bachelor's in economics, and the world of management consulting looked very shiny, very interesting. It offered the promise of building skills, of being exposed to multiple different industries, learning from extremely smart, extremely thoughtful people. So I jumped in and joined McKinsey & Company. And I have to say, it was a very, very also formative, powerful experience. I learned a lot. But at the same time, I looked around the room, so to speak, at McKinsey and other places as well, some of my clients, especially at the senior leaders. And the one thing that really struck me is many of them were not happy. Not to say that this was the case for everybody, but what really struck me was there was a lot of unhappiness, even at the very senior levels. And for me, as a young, fresh graduate, looking at Harvard MBAs, INSEAD MBAs, and so forth, somehow being unhappy, again, it brought the question back. Is there truly a formula to be happy, both privately or professionally, in a very integrated way? And so far, based on the data I was gathering, the data in my childhood and the data at McKinsey, the answer was not very optimistic. Let me just pause there. There's quite a lot there to unpack, but I think these are sort of the origins of what has led me to where I am today.
Well, thanks for sharing so honestly, first of all. I think lots of questions do arise, especially when it comes to this kind of blend between being successful in business, but also living a somehow fulfilled life, right? And so my first question would be, did you find an answer for yourself onto this question that you came up with?
It's a good question. I think the answer is something I continue to live to explore. I don't think there's a fixed answer, but for me, the simple answer is, how can I be of service? So in many ways, even though I was trying to find an equation to be personally happy in work life and private life, the answer actually was being of service. For now, that's my working hypothesis, and I'm happy to trace back. But I think that's how I think of the answer these days. When I help other people, I can be of service. I'm happy too.
When you look at several definitions of what it means to live a fulfilled life, and you also consider evolutionary perspectives, then if you look back into mankind and how we evolved as people, the whole human race, our whole species seems to be where it is because people were just supporting each other, like living as tribes, supporting each other and forming groups and somehow developing through this kind of human evolution, right? And at the same time, right now, you don't really need other people anymore, right? You can just do your thing. You just need a laptop. You can sit in your room. You can make money and you can survive. And at the same time, people seem to be more and more unhappy, even that we've such a tremendous evolution when it comes to economics or if you look at technology. So I can fully understand when you say that contributing to a better world, which is also meaning like working for other people, being in service, is something that makes life meaningful to you, if I got that right.
Yeah, and I think what you're naming, Kay, is a tension that many psychologists recently have identified, which is a tension between wanting to belong, wanting to be of service to the world, to others, and wanting to express your full human potential. Sometimes this is articulated as a tension between authenticity and belonging. If I use technical psychological words, it's between authenticity, self-expression, self-realization, and attachment. As kids, we wouldn't be here today if we didn't have the healthy attachment, or sometimes also healthy, to our caregiving figures in our life. And this is a perennial topic that I think even continues in corporations. And it's a much bigger topic, but I'm happy to sort of speak to that, at least on a personal level. So I fully hear you. We live in a context today where you can actually disregard the belonging, disregard the need to form a tribe, fully actualize yourself through a laptop, through being in your own space, and be very successful while you're at it. But I think there's an answer, which is both and. How do we actually express our full human potential and find a genuine sense of belonging and service at the same time? At least that's my ongoing aspiration. Can't say I found the answer, but it's a work in progress.
But we are getting there, maybe. And maybe coming back to that observation that you shared in the beginning, that the senior level and senior leadership, both at McKinsey and as well as clients, weren't that satisfied. I can recall that Frederic Laloux, in his book Reinventing Organizations, also shares the same observation. Yeah, then in 101s, he said, with the CXOs, he felt a lot of this dissatisfaction and even fear. Where is it coming from? And I mean, that is your experience, both as well as Frederic Laloux's experiences some time back. And now fast forward, have you seen progress in that respect now when you look at clients today?
Yeah, it's a good observation that Frederic has made. And I think it echoes a lot of the research as well that's out there. Maybe I'll start with the perspective from the wisdom traditions. It's actually a very simple perspective. Maybe almost too simple, but it resonates with me, which is everybody wants to be happy and free of suffering. It's a very, very simple perspective. But I would argue it's universal. It applies not just to human beings, but all creatures in the sky, in the sea, and so forth. Even bacteria, you could argue, right? When they multiply, they try to move towards thriving, shall we say. So I think that is sort of my starting point. And if I reflect on the state of the world today, thanks to challenges, for example, the pandemic, I think there's much more questioning of this topic. can we be happy both privately, professionally, and ultimately as a whole human being? I think the needle is moving slowly. But the challenge is in the world of business, especially when there are economic pressures, the almost default reaction is to double down on performance, achievement at all costs. Sometimes at the cost of your own happiness, at the cost of your people, you lose people, and ultimately sometimes you burn out as well. So I see promising signs towards a better integration of the private and professional, that's for sure. I see promising signs that people are actually much more in a serious way actually exploring the topic of genuine well-being overall in life. But at the same time, there are also lots of challenges in business that doesn't make this something easy to solve for necessarily.
Well, it's in business that it's not easy to solve it for. But one of the reasons that we have come up with this podcast is also there's one thing a business can do or an enterprise can do in creating an environment in which people flourish or thrive, as you just said. On the other hand, it's also the individual's responsibility. And I would even go that far. It's only the individual's responsibility to make sure that I am having a happy and fulfilled and satisfying life. And I need to take care of that because no one else will take care of that one. I mean, in the early days, I mean, there might be parents taking on that supervisory board position maybe, but ultimately it's us and only us. Would you agree with that one?
I think so. And again, I sort of reference the wisdom traditions as a very simple phrase. The Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh, who is in a way one of the modern fathers of the mindfulness movement. He has a very simple, short, almost two-verse poem, which is peace in oneself, peace in the world. So it starts with developing peace in oneself, and then ultimately that translates to peace in the world. We can unpack that on many, many levels, but I want to bridge that in two ways. One, on a personal level, a bit of a continuation of Kay's question, and then secondly, more on the organizational level as well. So I think for me, if I kind of circle back, so I had a experience of how not to run a family business. I had an experience and enough data around the unhappiness of many senior leaders, some of whom I thought were extremely smart, extremely bright. Not all, but many. Enough for me to question. And ultimately, I came across the Western traditions, in particular, the Zen Buddhist tradition, and was reading quite a bit. And I had the chance to meet a monk in person for the first time back then in Singapore. I was attending mindfulness retreat in the tradition of Thich Nhat Hanh, whom I just mentioned. And we had the opportunity to kind of book a one-on-one consultation with the monastics who were facilitating the retreat, but also to ask anything you would like. And I forget exactly what I asked, but what really struck me about the monk that I was speaking to was he seemed to have this quality of inner peace, not like he's, you know, completely tranquil and everything is fine. In fact, he just had this sense of okayness. This is the word I would use. He had this basic okayness about him. No matter how he was interacting with me, how he was behaving in the retreat, there was just an ease. And that got me really, really curious about the Western tradition. So for me, I found my own answer through going deep into the tradition, which still continues. For me, this was the Buddhist tradition, but there's so many wonderful Western traditions out there that offer methods basically to develop peace in oneself. And for me, this has been the game changer. And I don't say that lightly. I think it's transformed and continues to transform my entire life. Because if I can be joyful, peaceful, equanimous in myself, really doesn't matter what happens. It's not like I'm going to sort of switch off or shut down. But when I engage with the world, when I engage with challenges, whether at home with my wife, in my work, with clients, and it's not an easy time right now with the geopolitical context, with the economic context as well, but there's a way to, I think that at least I found a way for myself to be more at ease with it and to respond to it, actually. So I just want to sort of mention that. And then I'll move, Oliver, to your more to your question. There's research coming from adult development, in particular, Bob Kagan from Harvard. And he has, many models out there, but this is the one that I appreciate. He talks about different levels of adult development. And the top three levels he defines as the socialized mind, In other words, I define my identity based on the group that I belong to. After that comes the self-authoring mind, which is I step away from the group to define what is my identity, who is myself, what is my work, what is my life. And finally, the so-called highest level is what he calls the self-transforming mind, which is a realization that I'm not just a single identity, because life is so rich, context is constantly changing. I have the potential, the possibility to adopt multiple identities. I think the challenge, especially in the world of business, is that many high-achieving professionals tend to fall in the category of the socialized mind. His research shows that I think about approximately 85% of people fall in this category. In other words, they define their identity based on the organization that they belong in. And I'll be even more blunt here. Many professionals have a parent-child relationship with the organization. Organization is mommy and daddy. The professional is the child. They look to the organization to define who they should be, how they should behave. That's wonderful. But I think, Oliver, for your invitation to be real, to truly become the CEO of your life, you have to step away from purely defining your identity based on the organization, based on your profession, your trade, into self-authorship. That, I think, is a very, very critical step, which for me, the wisdom traditions offer many, many tools and techniques. The question, who am I, in some traditions, is the only question that they explore for an entire lifetime.
Mindful moment. Well, of what mind are you actually? Self-awareness is the first important step to make meaningful changes in your life, after all. So Moses talks about the three minds. First, we have the socialized mind, which those people have who define their identity based on the group or even company they belong to, who also feel a lot of dependence on belonging to that group. Then there is the self-authoring mind that people have who define their own identity, just like authors do. And lastly, there is the self-transforming mind that people have who don't just claim one identity, but keep reinventing themselves just as circumstances change throughout their lives. In your personal development, where do you think you fall in those categories? And what do you figure could be a step towards self-realization?
I have to go back to your experience, because you went very deep after McKinsey and joining a monastery and being there as a Zen monk for some time. How did that transform you or help you on your journey? And what can you share maybe here with the listeners?
Very happy to share. I had the good fortune at the time to engage as a monk. So I took vows, I shaved my head, I put on robes, and I moved into a Zen monastery with about 120 monks and nuns, about 4 hours northeast of Bangkok in Thailand. And I was there for about 4 months. It was kind of an internship, if you think about it. But I had to kind of basically quit my job. I was single at the time. I had to apply. They actually assessed me to see if I was suitable. And I was very lucky to be accepted to sort of join the monastery. For me, it was a profound opportunity to stop and look deeply at myself. Often, many of the Buddhist traditions is the practice of stopping and the practice of looking deeply. I think you would probably agree with me that the pace of our lives these days is only increasing faster and faster and faster. And it's not easy to stop. And if you don't stop, it's not easy to look deeply at your habit patterns, who you are, who do you want to be. So I think the environment of the monastery offered me the opportunity to stop and look deeply at who I am, to unlearn parts of myself that were not serving me, to embrace any parts of myself that I was rejecting, for example, from childhood or from some past wounds or trauma. for example, and ultimately to cultivate deeper awareness, wisdom, and compassion. And the journey still goes on. I wish I could tell you 4 months is all it takes, but it's not. But it gave me a very conducive environment. Imagine 120 people, all with the single focus of cultivating greater awareness, wisdom, and compassion, and supporting each other. It was a very, very supportive environment. And because it's also a large group of people, you know, also at home in a family, we fight, right? Because there are disagreements. Or at work, you fight with your colleagues. Good fights, sometimes bad fights, because of disagreements. So here as well, similarly, it's not like everyone there was enlightened. All human beings, we would rub each other the wrong way, but then that became an opportunity. If someone triggered you, to look at, again, to stop and to look deeply, to explore what's coming up for me. How do I untie that knot for myself? So that's sort of the entire experience in essence. I can give you a day in the life if you like, but I'm trying to sort of essentialize it.
Why did you leave then again? Because that sounds like an environment where, at least on that way to knowing who am I and living a satisfied life, that's kind of an, I wouldn't call it ideal environment, but at least a nourishing environment. Why did you leave that environment then?
It's a good question. And I think I have to balance what I say, that in order to experience that kind of conditions, that kind of nourishment, you also have to let go of many things, right? As a monk, I couldn't have a bank account. For example, I'm not supposed to own any assets. We had pocket money every month, for example, things like that. You engage in celibacy, you know, you give up your sexual life, for example. So there are all these sort of things you let go. So you're letting go in order to be more free. So there's this sort of strange equation of letting go into freedom that I think is worth mentioning. And I think, Oliver, you're very astute. I actually almost stayed. I was very, very close to staying. I really enjoyed it personally. It was a very simple life. I felt I was finding inner peace. There were also many people coming to the monastery for retreat all year round. And there was a way I could also support them, be it cooking in the kitchen or, you know, sitting in meditation with them. That was wonderful. But the question, how can I best be of service, was always and continues to be top of mind for me. I felt that I could be more of service outside the monastery. Because for people to arrive at a place like a monastery, like a retreat center, like a church, something like that, it really requires, firstly, an interest, and secondly, the willingness to step outside of your usual comfort zone. Therefore, there's a lot of self-selection to arrive at a place like a monastery. So therefore, the accessibility of some of the wisdom traditions is not that much. But is there a way to bring the tools, techniques, methods of the wisdom traditions, thousands of years old, to the place where people spend the bulk of their time, which is the workplace? And I was reflecting on my own history, growing up in the family business, being in McKinsey and in other consulting firms and other corporations. Is there a way to bridge the world of wisdom with the world of work? So that became something that really sort of galvanized me to say, much as I want to stay and I enjoy the life, I think it can be more of service outside.
What do you think from your experience, but also from your work with leaders, but maybe also with people who are not leaders? What are the benefits of inner development, Moses?
The late, great Harvard Business Professor Clayton Christensen wrote a beautiful article called How Will You Measure Your Life? I think it starts with that question. There's no simple answer or one answer, shall we say. But the question is, how will you measure your life? And I think that question prompts a lot of possibilities and prompts actually really a mindfulness of death, to be blunt. On your deathbed, how would you like to be remembered? Is it by the hours that you put into your work? Is it by the product that you've launched? Maybe. And if that's so, wonderful. Nothing good or bad about that. Is it about the family that you've brought up, the children that you've raised who are now good, responsible citizens in the world? Maybe. Maybe it's about creating something game-changing and innovation, right, that's available out there that's really positively impacting the lives of many people. So I think it starts with this question, how will you measure your life? And there are a few sort of sub-points here, almost points for reflection. First is to start with a place of gratitude, I think if possibly you're listening to this podcast, you already have a lot of conditions of a good life. Your stomach is not empty. You're in a place where you can be gainfully employed, have work. Wonderful. Right? So I think there's starting with gratitude is a good place to start. Right. But I think to complement that, it is, I think, quite necessary to reflect on how short and how precious this life really is. And I think these two sort of factors coming together then gives one some indications of what the measurement might be. I think from that, a lot of answers will emerge. The simple way to do this, if I give you a, shall we say, a shortcut, is to try out a meditation retreat for yourself. This can be a 2-day retreat, 5-day retreat, many, many options available. But the point is to turn down the noise of your daily life, your work, your commitments, and turn up the volume of insight and inner reflections. That's also another way to sort of shortcut this process. I think there's a quote from Pascal, all of man's problems are because of an inability to sit quietly in a room by themselves. What if you gave yourself the opportunity to sit quietly just for maybe a day or even 1 hour? Why not 30 minutes? See what comes from there. So I think it's creating that space, that zone of freedom where some of these answers can slowly emerge.
I need to jump into that one because that's bothering me all the time. Now, in large corporations, and you are consulting many and you have seen many of them, there is this productivity paranoia. That's not my word, that's Microsoft words. And that 1 hour you just mentioned, sitting still, doing nothing, just listening inside. Now, I hear you and I know it's a good thing to do. Now, how to convince people out there that this hour is an hour worthwhile spent. It is, quote unquote, I wouldn't call it productive, but supporting everything else. Many people in this podcast talking about meditation, this is a kind of a red thread going through it. And it is taking up in society, I see it, still, yeah, talking about that gap that you just mentioned between professional development and inner development. I think it has the potential to close it, but how can we make it more attractive and getting it out of that esoteric corner?
Yeah, it's a really great question, Oliver. And I think the context of the AI disruption is also relevant here. And I'll sort of bring that up briefly. But if I had a sort of slogan to market this, shall we say, slow down to speed up. In slowing down, in stopping and looking deeply, you gain much more awareness, wisdom, and even perhaps compassion that can then supercharge your ability to lead yourself, your teams, and your people. Maybe almost too simplistic here, but I think if there was a marketing slogan I would get behind that has worked, it is slow down to speed up. Why is it that leaders, teams go offsite to strategize for the year, for the quarter? Because they need the space to slow down to speed up. If CEOs are doing that for their companies, are you doing that for your own life? Because only you can be the CEO of your own life, right? There's almost a clear sort of correlation there. And I think bringing the AI context here is very important. In the age of AI, and McKinsey calls AI the new steam. In other words, AI is the fuel that powers the ongoing fourth industrial revolution. This is a big statement to me. I'm of the view that AI is very much game-changing, continues to be in its early stages of adoption and exploration. But the question is, what does it mean to be someone in the world of work in the age of AI? Question mark. And at Potential Project, and actually we have some research here that is work in progress. I'll give you a bit of a preview here. Essentially, it is important to embrace AI and all that it promises, and equally important to double down on being human. Specifically, from a cognitive psychology perspective, there are three qualities. Awareness, you need to know where you are. Wisdom, you need to make choices. And compassion, which is the ability to make things happen and bring others along with you. And one of the time and tested ways to supercharge awareness, wisdom, and compassion is meditation. It's almost a bit of a black and white here. You can download the apps that, you know, maybe remind you and nudge you and prompt you That's like doing the mini reps. If you want to go to the gym for your inner development, that gym is meditation. And if you want to stay relevant in the age of AI, our research, and personally, I would argue, the only thing that would really truly differentiate you, capacity to be aware, your capacity to be wise and make choices, and your capacity to be compassionate as well. That's what's going to separate top performers, top leaders, top employees from the pack. That's our hypothesis, and the research so far seems to back that up. So if you wanted the business case, Oliver, I don't know if that's what you're asking for. That's also what I'm offering.
Mindful moment. Meditation indeed seems to be a common thread that we keep revisiting on this show, which of course raises the question to you. Have you already created little islands of space for yourself? Have you started to slow down in order to speed up? Whether you haven't yet at all, or you wish to deepen your meditation practice, this is your invitation to do the next little step. You could look up a meditation group in your area, book that day retreat, or simply start looking up a YouTube tutorial and give yourself 10 minutes of undisturbed space. You know, it doesn't have to be perfect, just as long as you start somewhere.
I don't know if you know this study about the researchers who were showing pictures to their participants about a syringe needle being stuck to a hand, right? And so people were close to getting pinned with the needle. And what the researchers could see is that the same areas in their brains got activated as the ones from the person who actually got stung by the needle, which is showing that we are, like, from a neurological perspective, we are meant to be empathetic, which makes sense from an evolutionary perspective, because if we wouldn't have been so, then we wouldn't have cared for each other and our species wouldn't be there where it is. At the same time, what the researchers found out is that as soon as we believe or see someone as someone who's not part of, let's call it our group, whatever that might mean from a religious perspective, from a politics perspective, or even like be it from a different football club, right? Then this kind of empathy level, it dropped nearly to zero, which means, to conclude on that, it's really easy to be empathetic for someone you like, okay? Now, if I think of being a team leader, like, and it's like, it's normal, right? If you've got a team of, let's say, 20, 30, 40 people, and there are people you like more and there are others that you probably don't like so much. It's just the way humans are being structured. So how do people apply or like evolve in becoming more compassionate towards those kind of people they got some kind of feelings for that could be improved, so to say?
Okay, I think you're touching on a very important topic. If we look at many of our challenges in the world today, it is precisely from this sense of self versus other, my group versus another group. A lot of research showing that there's increased polarization in the world at this time, presently as we speak, politically in many ways. And if we look at the organizational context, a lot of big transformations fail because people across different functions fail to go across their functions to really become one team and work towards a common destination. And we also know, of course, you know, on a more team context, embracing diversity. Diversity is wonderful, right? We know that. But to unlock the potential of diversity is not easy. So first things first is you have to believe that this is worth your time. If you don't believe this is worth your time, then it doesn't matter. But the research here is showing that if you take a team that is very similar, right? In other words, you can relate to the people in your team, and you take a team that is very different, and there's a lot of safety in the team, and you take a team that is very different, but there's no safety, how do you think that these three themes will perform? So let's take the first two examples. Homogeneous team, similar team versus a team that is different, but there's safety. Of course, the team that is very safe, that is very different, will outperform the homogenous team. But if you compare the homogenous team to the third option, the team that is very different, lots of diversity, but no safety, the homogenous team will actually outperform this team. Right? So first, you have to believe that this is worth your while. If you don't believe that, then you're out of the game already. So I think that's important to mention. And the second, and maybe an oversimplistic answer, is curiosity. Can you actually get curious about this person who's very different from you? Can you see that as a way to expand your worldview? You don't have to like the person, but can you get curious about someone who is very different from you, to understand them from their voice, from their perspective? And then that helps you actually to create that human-to-human connection. The problem is we make assumptions about people that we don't understand. So I would say the very, very simple recommendation I have is I should get curious. And when there's something that maybe is even you find challenging about this person's background or culture or whatever it is, ask them with a lot of curiosity. Please help me to understand something about you. I think that's a very, very simple way to do it. And again, from a wisdom tradition perspective, meditation at its, shall we say, more advanced levels is about removing the separation between self and other. If we can lift that line, that invisible line, or at least weaken it, right, and see this person not as part of your team, our team, there's a natural wish to understand, to support, to be of service. So I think, speaking of research as well, research on Olympian meditators, meditators who have meditated for 10,000 hours or more, showed that their resting brainwave is a gamma brainwave. This might sound trivial if you don't know what a gamma brainwave is, but it is the fastest brainwave possible. It often happens when there are moments of insight, when there are moments of aha. And what is insight and aha? It's simply curiosity. So again, I'm just trying to correlate back. Curiosity might be a very simple answer here, but from a wisdom tradition perspective, if you bring a vast beginner's mind curiosity to your interactions with people, you can start to soften the lines between this is my group versus this the other group, and the empathy will come more naturally.
When I asked the question, I was actually expecting another answer. So I'm really grateful for this one, because this is expanding my worldview. I expected you to start by talking about similarities and what kind of qualities are making us all equal. But thank you for the curiosity part. Really appreciate that.
And Kay, if I may, there's a very simple practice in the wisdom tradition. It's called Just Like Me, you know. And the very basic Just Like Me, which I've already said, is Just Like Me, Kay and Oliver want to be happy. If we bring that basis to our human interactions, I think that a lot can improve quite naturally.
It sounds so easy. And I think if we think about it, we find many more commonalities. But it's so easy, and the default mechanism, it seems to me, I'm wondering whether you share that, our default mechanism is to distinguish, as you said, the self versus the others, the inner group versus the outer group, because it helps to create identity and belonging, and that is a powerful driver. Now, how can we overcome that one? It costs energy to create that common ground for a broader group, for other people as well. We all want to be happy.
Yeah. All of the two reflections to offer. The first, you said it's too easy. And so true. One of my teachers likes to say that awareness, wisdom, and compassion is too easy. Nothing rocket science. And it's too close. The capacity to be aware, wise, and compassionate is already there. But so close that we can't see it. So we don't believe it. We have this capacity. So that's more of a throwaway comment I'll make, but there's a lot of truth in that we don't believe it. It's too easy. So, and then I think there's a broader piece here. Come back to the idea of polarities. Is there a way for us in our life and work to first embrace similarities? So, okay, I think you were expecting me to say focus on similarities first. I think that's important. And that could be having a common team purpose, having a common organizational purpose, or having a common purpose as a family, for example, right? And can we complement that with a differences focus, right? So similarities focus and difference focus. you may have noticed recently that in the DEI world, and that whole space is going through a huge rethink right now. They've added a B word, belonging. And I come back to this comment I made earlier, this perennial tension between authenticity, differences focus, and belonging, similarity focus. Right. So I think the answer maybe is a little nuanced here, but I'd like to offer it. First is you need to be at home in yourself. When you're at home in yourself, you're not guarded. You're not on the defense constantly. I really think it starts there. You know, you need to be at home in yourself, right? And then I think secondly, if you're a team leader or even within your own family, can you embrace similarities, right? What creates belonging for us as a unit? And then can you embrace and get curious about differences? Why is my son or daughter this way? Why is this person this way? Not from a place of judgment, but from genuine curiosity. So I think balancing these two things are important, because if you overfocus on similarities, you're reinforcing the group identity and you're ignoring the diversity. And if you overfocus on diversity or differences, then you may lack a common glue for the unit overall. Now, for me, that's belonging.
Mindful moment. To connect more deeply with others, to remove the veil of disconnect, Moses recommends a balance of two strategies. Finding similarities that connect with the other person and inviting genuine curiosity. Now, think about somebody in particular or even a group you wish to connect with more. This is your friendly challenge to actually follow through by focusing on these two pillars, by asking curious questions and being authentically interested in that person. Questions could sound like this. What's something you're currently working on that excites you? What's something that brings you joy? How do you like to unwind after a busy day of work? And what's something you've learned recently that surprised you? You know, people tend to light up when given the space. So go and light up some people, and maybe even yourself.
So I like that idea of both, and you know, it's always this, you need to be at both. And at the same time, it seems to be much easier to be just in one corner. It's easy, too easy maybe to be just for one thing or against one other thing. In particular, in this fast-paced world, as soon as you start trying to say, yeah, you can see it from this angle and that angle, in any discussion, you tend to lose, in particular in a business environment. So that value tag that you just put on, that approach, both and, more ambiguous rather than either or. Is there any practice or anything you can recommend to train that muscle?
I'm going to sound like a broken tape recorder all over. But first, let me just reflect that I think a both and perspective can be very advantageous in the world of business. And we have to acknowledge that there are politics and power structures in the world. This is often the blind spot of leadership. People don't want to talk about that sufficiently. That's a whole topic we can talk about another time. But I think sometimes another way to describe compassion is finding skillful ways to get to solutions. So you may explore different perspectives, but what is the best way for you to offer your perspectives and the best way for you actually to get to not a zero sum win or lose, but a win-win? That's not always possible, I'm aware, but I think this is one thing to consider. And I keep going back to meditation, but I, in the research, especially in the world of AI, more and more and more reveals that you have to go to the gym for your mind. You have to go to the gym for inner development. The same way we go to the gym for our bodies, we go for a run for our bodies, especially knowledge workers, if you are not investing in your inner development, you're going to lose. And I'm creating a binary here of win or lose. But I think it's that simple. You have to invest in your inner development. And most meditative traditions, most wisdom traditions, always two styles of practices. Stopping. Cultivating the ability to stop, to pause, to slow down. And looking deeply. Insight. Insight is the ability to look across boundaries, to look across silos, to look across groupings, to explore synergies, to explore possibilities. So these two practices are almost two wings of meditation, stopping, looking deeply. When they come together, the Olympian meditators show us that our default brainwave can be a gamma state of total responsiveness. So that would be my recommendation.
And is there anywhere people have now got more interested in you? And I could imagine that, where they can find more about you, where would they be able to find you and maybe dig deeper on your wisdom?
That's very kind, Oliver. I'm only standing on the shoulders of many of the teachers I have. So it's very kind of you to say that. But happy to connect on LinkedIn if people would like to connect. That's probably the easiest way. And from a potential project perspective, our website is a good place as well. But feel free to reach out on LinkedIn and happy to connect.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Moses.
Thank you for having me here in Oliver.
Wow, what a session. So, Kai, I don't know what you took along, but I definitely wrote down slow down to speed up. Yeah, you have to lead yourself in order to be able to lead others. It was very thickly underscored in my notes. Also, when Moses talked about compassion and also what it means and differentiated it with empathy. So you need both. You need emotion and compassion, not only to be a good leader, but in order to lead a good life. I like this end, this both end, working with polarities, he called it. It's not either or, it's more this both end. It's both ends of the spectrum. They are not mutually exclusive, but you have to take both of them into account, again, to lead a more fulfilled life and probably also, it's not his words, but to be more compassionate with your environment. Yeah, and then last but not least, I like that picture that he gave us. You have to go to the gym for your mind. So I think many of us have accepted we need movement, we need exercise, we need training for our body. And again, his words, we also need a gym for our mind. So which he does with meditation, for instance, but he gave us many more things, how we can exercise our mind.
Yeah, and I think I can totally relate, like what you just said with regards to that you need to go to the gym with your mind. I mean, this became even more clearer to me when he was coming up with this abbreviation about PAID, which stands for like high pressure, always on information overload and being distracted. I mean, if you just think about it, these seem to be invisible things, and that's why they don't seem to count so much, and people seem to like neglect them or not really taking care of these kind of external factors. But if they were visible, it would be even more transparent to us how important it is to have this kind of gym routine for the mind. So I found this really insightful. Then you also talked about empathy, you talked about compassion, and surely what Moses was saying when it came to strengthening your own self-awareness does also relate to that. And it does also relate to, and that was interesting, the processing power of the two minds that he was distinguishing when he said it's around 7 bits in your conscious minds and 11 million bit in your subconscious mind. And to like go on purpose into your rather subconscious mind. And if it's just like by taking a walk, by washing the dishes, by whatever kind of activity comes to your mind that is somehow slowing your conscious mind and your thinking down, and this huge ability that goes along with that. I found this also really fascinating. And last but not least, the four dimension to consider when it comes to living a fulfilled life, like having a great balance between working or being of service and learning as well as your inner development and also not forgetting about play. I think that's a great picture, at least for myself, to reflect maybe once a week whether I somehow served all of these four dimensions.
Very well. Then we close the session today. And if you, dear listener, like this session, then please like it also on your favorite podcast platforms. Follow us, and we will be back with the next session in 2 weeks from now in German again. And up and until then, take care of yourself, take care of each other, and stay curious.